Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I have a very special guest today. I have Frank Zaffiro, who is a retired police officer in the state of Washington. And it was Washington, right, Frank?
That's where I did my policing and grew up. Moved to Oregon about 6 years ago or so.
But I got you.
Still pretty much the same to everybody on the East Coast, I'm sure.
Okay. Well, post-police career, Frank has become an author of note. He's written several books, mainly in the true crime genre. So welcome to the Gritty Hour, Frank. It's good to have you on board.
Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. So you were retired police in Spokane, and then you moved to Oregon, and now you have a little writer's nook that you're sitting in there, right? And you seem to be very prolific. I'll give you that. There's a lot of books out there. So tell me how you got the transition for you. Tell me about the transition.
Well, the key to the transition is it wasn't entirely a transition. I always identified myself as a writer, kind of the same way that maybe a musician might, as a young kid, decide they're a musician, and that's just always a part of their life. I wrote all through school and after I graduated and went into the military, and even when I started, after I came on the job. But I did have a bit of a hiatus there after I became a police officer in 93, from about 95 to 04, where I just didn't really write a whole lot of fiction. Cause I was, I'd gone back to school full time. I was getting my undergraduate degree in history. And so there's a lot of reading and writing there. And I was learning a new position with the police department, from rookie to training officer to corporal to detective and sergeant. And so it was always something new. Of course, there's always a lot of writing and work of that nature going on in policing as well. So there's a dry spell there fiction-wise. But I really started writing pretty heavily in about 2004 when I met another police officer and we became pretty good friends and bonded over our love of writing. His name's Colin Conway, who I've written six books with now. So it's a pretty good partnership. This is all a long way of saying that, I retired in 2013, but I didn't retire and then start writing. When I retired in 2013, I'd been writing for publishing, I guess, for 9 years at that point. So it was more a transition into doing it full time rather than to starting it from scratch.
So you were a writer disguised as a cop for 20 years.
In a way, you kind of figure out, you can't just put a sign out that says, look at me, mom, I'm a writer, and somebody just starts cutting you a check. Most writers have a day job and for me, that day job was either going to be teaching or policing. And really what it came down to, if I'm being honest, the coin flip was that I had about a year and a half of college when it was time to get the job, and I didn't want to go, another 2.5 years to get my teaching certificate. I could start working for the police as soon as I could get hired. Uh-huh. So, and I tested well and ended up high on the list. So it was a pretty sure thing, and had a wife and a kid and, doubled my salary as soon as I got hired. It was a pretty easy decision in that regard.
Yeah.
And it's, I had a great career. A lot of things I'm really glad I experienced. And when you tie it to the writing career, it's really been beneficial.
Very good. And you served in the military. What branch did you serve in?
I was in the U.S. Army from 1986 to 1991.
Oh.
I was in military intelligence. I was a Czechoslovak linguist.
Wow.
Which technically, actually, if you want to get technical, I was a spy. that sounds really awesome to some people. But the reality of it was I put on headphones like the ones you're wearing and listened to the Czech Army chatter on their radios and, interpreted and, spied on them that way. And so calling it a spy is a little more grand than what it was.
Well, thank you for your service, Frank. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
In addition to the writing of the books, and we're going to get to that in a minute, the individual books, you also run a podcast yourself called Wrong Place, Write Crime, W-R-I-T-E, Crime. Did that evolve out of the book writing, or was it concurrent?
Yeah, it did. It did. I came out of a couple of things. The first one really was that a writer buddy of mine who I wrote several books with, three book series, named Eric Buettner, him and another guy, S.W. Loudon, they put out a podcast called Writer Types, which it's still available. You know, it's an evergreen thing, the podcast, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And Writer Types is a fantastic podcast, and the two of them are pretty funny, and it's just really well produced. Eric's job is he's an editor in the television field, and so, you know, it's just really well cut together too. Mm-hmm. And I got to enjoying what they're doing. I was like, wow, that sounds like a lot of fun, you know, talking to these other authors. And then the other piece that came up was, you know, they're promoting other authors. They're giving back to the community, the writing community. They're helping out their fellow writers. And I always felt like, and I know Eric and Steve felt this way too, which is why they did the podcast. It's not a zero sum game in this field. Like, you know, if you and I are competing over somebody buying a used car, it kind of is a zero sum game. They're not going to buy both cars. But if you and I both wrote a book, there's a better than middling chance that the person might decide to read both, you know, and just because they pick yours doesn't mean they can't pick mine too, and vice versa. So promoting your fellow writers is, you know, you're not cutting your own throat by doing that. And so you know, you can feel good about it. Mm-hmm. And so those two things kind of came together to make me decide to take a stab at it. But I couldn't do like Eric and Steve were doing, because they're funny and they had a partnership going and everything. And so they had like this AM morning drive kind of vibe. You know what I'm talking about? You know,
yeah.
Short, punchy segments and a lot of humor and everything. I decided to go the other route. I went with the 2 a.m. on a long stretch of highway, two people talking about ostensibly whatever the guest is an expert in, but long-ranging conversations from there. Uh-huh. Something to keep you company on that overnight drive when you're, you know, nothing but the radio towers keep you company sort of thing. And right. And that's what kicked it off 160 episodes ago.
Oh, very good. I did check out a couple of them, and you do bring on authors. They seem, at least the ones I checked out, seem to be writing in the same genre that you write in, the crime, true crime. And in that sense, to your point, it makes perfect sense. Someone that's interested in that kind of novel, you know, it's a self-serving thing in addition to promoting someone else.
Yeah, I would say probably a good 70% of the writers I bring on are, of the guests I bring on are crime fiction authors in my general genre. But I mean, I've had cozy authors on too, which is completely out of my wheelhouse. And I've tried to throw a few curveballs every once in a while. I brought on one of the best interviews I had was with the humorist Christopher Moore. But there's a little bit of a tie in there too, though, because he had his book Noir was coming out, which, you know, kind of makes fun of those old 40s noir movies. And so right. Even there's a tie in there too. But it's been really great. I mean, I'm sure you experience it as well. You get a chance to meet people you may never have met, or bring your buddies on and push them, you know. And,
this is the case in point is tonight. I get to meet a gentleman from Oregon, which I would never do in my daily life. So it's the underlying reason why I think most people do a podcast, you know. So you're right. So when you do the right place, the wrong place, right crime podcast, when you bring an author on, what do you generally do? You're just promoting them, or do you get into a discussion about your style versus theirs or their writing style and that kind of stuff?
I made a decision really early on that the focus of the show was always, at least during the interview for sure, going to be on the author. And so I keep the spotlight on them as much as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I'm not afraid to be there with them for a minute or two to, you know, if the conversation goes that way. But, you know, I edit it, I don't do it live. And so I can tell you that a large swaths of my own rambling gets snipped out often, you know. It may have moved the conversation in a direction that worked, but you don't need to hear me say all that stuff.
And right, right, right.
So I pretty liberally cut my own chatter because the purpose is to promote that author. And sometimes it's because they have a new book coming out, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. sometimes it's just to you know, my ultimate goal would be that there's somebody listening who either A, really likes that author and wants to hear a little inside baseball about them, mm-hmm. You know, how they came up with a character or what's the next book they're going to do or something like that. Or they discover someone they've never heard of before. And then maybe they're like, hey, I'm going to check that person out. And it mm-hmm. turns out they've just discovered their newest favorite author. And
yeah.
if either one of those things happens, I think that's a huge win.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, while we continue this conversation, I usually say this when I have an author on. Frank's website will be in the show notes just below, and also a link to his podcast will be in the show notes just below. And speaking of the website, I'm gonna share that for people to see that are watching us on YouTube to see your website. And then I want to discuss some of the books you've written. I kind of have a guess as to where you get your inspiration from, but maybe you can describe to us, because you are a very prolific writer, and I just wanted to know where you get your inspiration from, essentially.
Yeah, I was just updating my writing credits to have, you know, something you want to have ready if somebody asked for your CV, and I hadn't updated it in quite some time. And if I include books under both my pen name and my real name, I'll be at 39 novels in June.
Wow. With
the two June releases. So that's not bad. I mean, I was told my wife, you know, I mean, if you had told me 25 years ago that at this age, I'd be sitting on almost 40 novels and continuing to put out new ones, then I'd be pretty thrilled with that. But this is my flagship series you're looking at here, my main series. That book, Under a Raging Moon, was mm-hmm. my very first book. And since it's the first book, it's one of those things like it has a special place in your heart, and you're also mildly embarrassed about it because it's probably your weakest work. you know, but River City is a very thinly veiled Spokane. Part of the reason I used a pen name and part of the reason why I used River City instead of Spokane was to put a little distance between myself and my reality when I was still on the job. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit of being careful there. But you can see some of these covers are, you know, especially that first one, that's an iconic bridge in River City, or in Spokane, rather. Mm-hmm. That's the Monroe Street Bridge. And you know, a lot of them have those kind of cityscape covers. And River City is basically, I mean, depending on what age you are, you'll attach to one of these shows or the other. A lot of people have compared it to Hill Street Blues or NYPD Blue, or if you're a little newer to the game, Southland is a pretty good example. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, it's an ensemble cast of police officers and eventually detectives and even eventually the leadership members. And you get the third person view, so it jumps around from character to character to a degree. But there are some core characters that get more time, and you can see here in the first paragraph, in the first book, you've got Stefan Kopriva, the young hotshot. I thought he was going to be the star of the series. Turned out I was wrong. Then you got the veteran Carl Winter, who's about to retire, and then Tom Chisholm, who is kind of the sage officer. He's the one who everybody respects, and he has all the wisdom and institutional knowledge. And if people are trying to figure out what a good patrol cop looks like, that's the model that they pick.
Right.
Now, who isn't listed here in this first book, but is in the book, is an officer named Katie McLeod. And she has kind of a support role in this book and a little bigger role in the next book. But by the third book, if you scroll down to the bottom of this page here, you'll see the next book in the series. And I think I changed it to where it's just the next one. Yeah. The third book, Beneath a Weeping Sky, Katie becomes the core, at least the emotional core of the series. And book 8 will come out later this summer. And I would say that's still the case. So,
Is she a police officer in the book?
Yeah, she's a patrol officer at the beginning. She's a peer of Kopriva. Uh-huh. Same, 3 years on when the series starts, and people age and as time passes, their roles change. I mean, spoiler alert, but as this eighth book comes out, Katie's in the detective's office now. And so you see the progression of people's careers and people leave the job and new people come on, but it's a slow process. I mean, you don't get attached to someone and they're gone in the next book, for the most part. It's over the course of books that things change. And my goal really with this series, when I first started it, and it remains the case, was I wanted to show police officers I wanted to show the humanity of the officers. I mean, a lot of people, they see the badge, they see the uniform, they see all the tools, or they see the headlines, and they never really see the individual that's wearing that badge or that uniform. And so I wanted to show some of that. I wanted to show the world through the eyes of these officers and what they go through, what they deal with, why they deal with things a certain way, and so forth, because it is a procedural. It does delve into the whys and the hows a lot. But I wasn't going to make them, Dudley Do-Rights or whatever. I mean, they make mistakes and they have frustrations and they are not perfect. They fail sometimes because nobody's perfect. Mm-hmm. And neither are they. But they're not, they're imperfect because they stumbled and failed, not because of any malice or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the deal with that series, and it's been a nice long ride with it. I've enjoyed it, and I've got a pretty good arc planned out over the next few years with it.
You're gonna stick with the River City series? You're gonna stick with the River City series?
Yeah. I don't think it's. I think I would guess another 6 or 7 books at least.
Wow.
Before I think about whether to maybe give it a rest for a while. Mm-hmm. I have a destination in mind for a couple of the characters that I definitely want to see them get to. The other thing I've done with this series is there's 7 of them out now that are in the series proper. But there are, if you go up to the top there and click on novels again, right there next to home, just mm-hmm. click on the novels there. There you go. Yeah. It'll take you to, no, don't go down. Just click on that. There you go. Now scroll down. The page itself, not the menu.
Oh, you want to click on novels. Yeah.
Yeah. You already did it. Just go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
You're good.
Sorry about that. Okay.
So, no, you're okay. So here's the city, the River City series proper. And there's an eighth one coming out. The Worst Kind of Truth will be out this summer. But if you scroll down near to the bottom of the page, you will also see, what I call River City standalones. And those are books that take place in the River City universe. And there we go. Mm-hmm. There they are. So all 3 of these books take place in River City with River City characters. They're canon, if you will. They're part of the timeline, but they take place outside of the strict timeline. In other words, River City started in 1994. The new book is in 2008. But these take place in 2014, 2010, 2005, respectively, if you're going from left to right. So, as I write these other books and move the main series along, if a good story comes along that's outside that rigid timeline, I can always do this. I can always jump in and tell a standalone that's still set in the River City world.
Are the characters similar, or is it the same? It's not the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
The same police officers involved?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. I see.
In some cases, they're further along in their career. Like in the middle one, Chisholm's Debt, Thomas Chisholm is that, that sage officer I mentioned in the first book. And he's like a 14-year vet at the time. And in this book here, it takes place after he retires. And he doesn't retire until the end of the seventh book in the regular series, in the main series, if you will. So I don't know if this is making sense timeline wise, but you know, the main series is very strictly chronological. These kind of take place outside of that, but they're part of the series universe.
So your fans that are following the River City as they come out, as you said, the eighth book will be out in a couple of months. They can refer to the standalone ones while they're waiting for the next one.
And they'll run into a few spoilers, but nothing that's going to rock their socks. I mean, nothing that they're going to be like, oh my gosh, you know, that ruins the whole rest of the series for me or whatever. I mean, there no huge spoilers.
Mm. I was fortunate you were gracious enough to send me a novella about the robbery of a mummy, which I found very interesting. Yeah, and I got a good glimpse of your writing style, and you do write down to earth, which I enjoy that. When you develop a character, like say you mentioned that police officer, the female police officer. Does the character you develop then dictate what happens to them? This is just a writer's question. Do you let that decide what happens to them?
You kind of have to, I think. Mm-hmm. If you've been honest in creating or understanding that character, however you want to put it, if you try to shoehorn that character into activities or behaviors or choices that he or she wouldn't actually make, they fight back and it doesn't work. And if you don't catch it, your beta readers or your editors will, for sure. Uh-huh. And so, yeah, I've had to quite a few times decide that the nice little plot twist I wanted isn't necessarily going to work because, you know, Katie's too smart for that, or, you know, whatever the case may be, that it just, you know, like you said, they kind of start to dictate their own paths to a degree.
Right. Tell me a little bit about this Charlie 316 series.
This is a cool series. It's also a procedural series. My buddy Colin, we wrote that book, Some Degree of Murder, one of the standalone River City books together. And, you know, way back in like 2005 and back around 2017 or 18, we'd been exchanging our work, you know, editing for each other, reading each other's stuff and continuing to encourage each other, in our careers. And he reaches out to me and he says, "Hey, I've got this great idea for a book, but I kind of want you to come in on it with me because it, you know, it's about this police officer who's kind of a golden child of the department and he gets in a shooting that looks bad. And I want to explore what happens. Like, will the city hang him out to dry for political reasons or what?" You know, I want to explore that. I think it's relevant today and it'll be interesting. But, you know, he was a cop too for 5 years. But his role in the police department was he was a patrol officer and then he moved into a kind of a bureaucratic position working with businesses and licensing and stuff around the city. And then at the end of his career, he became the union president, which broke him. He did not enjoy that experience at all. And in fact, that's when he left the job. He went back into real estate where he's been very successful. Uh-huh. And he said, "You know, I don't want to get over my skis on the kind of stuff that happens in an officer-involved shooting at the higher levels of the police department because I'd been a captain. I'd been in those rooms and, you know, seen those, the politics and so forth." So he wanted me to work on it with him. So I was like, "It sounds like a great story. Let's go to work." So he had this skeleton of a story. We hung all the meat and skin on it, started rounding it out, you know, figured out what our writing process was going to be. And we knocked it out really fast. And it was some of the best work I think that either of us had done. And at the end of the book, we're like, "Wow, I think I just realized something. This story's not over." like it's over, but the arc isn't over. So these first four books, Charlie 316, Never the Crime, Badge Heavy, and Code 4, we call that the Tyler Garrett arc because it kind of follows the arc of this character, the officer I mentioned at the beginning, through what happens to him. I mean, in the first book, the first chapter, the first book, it's no spoiler here, he gets in the shooting that I mentioned, but there's a few things that are different than your average shooting. For one thing, that it's a traffic stop that occurs when the shooting happens on a traffic stop, but there's no gun found at the scene. And the victim is struck in the back by the bullets, the motorist, the suspect, whatever you want to label him. And so that's a problem. And then, you know, in the policing world, you see a lot of controversial shootings that tend to be a white officer and a black suspect. And in this case, in Spokane, which is about 87% white, I think, we have a black officer and a white victim suspect, however you want to label him. So we kind of flipped the script a little bit on that as well. And immediately after the shooting, things just go haywire all up and down the spectrum, you know, from police leadership to City Hall, to the media, to the officer himself, to the investigators that have to do the investigation from the other, from the county sheriff's office, the outside organization, to the police detective from the Spokane PD who's assigned to shadow those detectives to follow their investigation and kind of look out for the interests of the police department. And that's Detective Wardell Clint, who's a rather prickly individual. His nickname is Honey Badger. So you can imagine how well he gets along with his coworkers. and it goes from there. So that is a four book arc. The Ride Along is the book. It just came out in May. And after we finish this four book arc, now the books that are coming out in this series, they're still in the universe. They're still happening subsequent to the events of the first four books, but they also stand alone a little more. And in the Ride Along, you have a police reform activist who's a teacher who gets a ride along with the police department, which means she's going to ride with a police officer in a patrol car for 10 hours. She's put in a car with a third generation cop who's just a true blue, you know, bleeds blue officer. He's a good cop, a good guy. But the two of them have very different views on contemporary policing, how and what might need to change, how to interpret everything surrounding the topic. And because of this, sparks fly in the patrol cruiser, not of the romantic kind. And eventually they reach a little bit of a truce in which they're able to exchange some ideas and even listen to each other a little bit. It's no kumbaya story by any stretch, but it was born out of my frustration that a lot of people in the public don't understand policing, but make a lot of judgments anyway. And since I retired almost a decade ago, I also see some things that we in law enforcement don't do ourselves any favor and need to do much better at. And in both instances, people were, you know, yelling slogans and, you know, trying to say their piece, but not doing a lot of listening to the other view or trying to understand where maybe the middle ground was.
Right.
And since nobody was listening, I put two people in a position where they had to listen to each other. And I made sure that neither one is a straw person here. They both get an equal chance to speak their truths, to listen to the other person. I try to be, both Colin and I try to be very, even-handed in presenting the characters so that wherever you are on this subject, whatever you believe or think, you should encounter times in this book where you go, yes, I'm glad that point got made. And you should come across some moments where you go, no, that's ridiculous. I totally disagree. And hopefully a few moments where you go, I've never really thought about it that way before. I didn't realize that, or I'm going to need to think about that for a second. And if we can get people to do that a little bit, then maybe we nudge the conversation just an inkling, you know, in the right direction.
Right. I was going to ask you a question about, developing a whole new set of characters and how that affects you as the writer, but now you got me wondering when you're doing the ride along, who the points of view I guess are being expressed during the during the book. And did you write both ends of that point of view? Did you explore both points of view?
I did. The first four books, the way... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, how did you do it?
Well, the first four books, you know, Colin and I outlined them together. We brainstormed them together and we rewrote them together. We tended to each pick a certain few characters and we would write those characters with a few that we both wrote, just depending on convenience. But it was pretty equal. When I came up with the idea for a ride-along, it was initially a short story idea. I just thought it would be a short story. And then I realized it was too big of a topic and decided to make it a novel. And I was halfway through it when I had yet to put it in an actual location. It was in Anytown, USA, right? Mm-hmm. And I came to realize that it didn't have the impact only talking about the national concepts, this event in Cleveland or that event in New York or this event in Los Angeles. It didn't have the same bite because nothing was happening in the local community. And so I knew I had to place it in a real place. And it's a, I could take you through the whole process, but the upshot of it is I realized that the Charlie 316 version of Spokane was the right place to put it. So I chatted with Colin about it and he said, let's do it, but this is a little different. So why don't you just finish the first draft and then we'll do the editing the way that we normally do, which is we both edit viciously and we, you know, knock it back and forth till we're both happy with it. And it's no holds barred. So I did, I wrote the whole first draft, and the way I approached it, to answer your second part of your question there, it was easy for me on the police side because I'd experienced most of what Lee Salter, the officer, is experiencing, the thoughts, the frustrations.
Right.
And so for me, that was just a matter of thinking about it and remembering. And I have friends that are still in the job or are also retired that I've known well. And so I did mine a few of them with some thoughts to make sure I wasn't completely out of touch, having been retired for you know almost a decade. But it's that time of having been retired for almost a decade that gave me some insight into the other side of the coin, into the police reform activist side of it.
Right.
I mean, I'd heard all those arguments. I'd been in those discussions with folks. I've considered some of the things that they've talked about and actually agree with some of them. I do think that we do need to reform policing. It's not as radically as some people are opining, but definitely some of the suggestions I've heard are good ones. And so I did the research on what I didn't already know about. And I just really, I promised myself it was going to be a 50-50 deal. So when I was writing Melody, I was on her side 100%. I believed everything she believed. And in those scenes, I presented it with that level of conviction. When I wrote Lee, I did the same thing for him. And getting into the skin of whichever, you know, whoever's chapter it was, because the chapters alternate back and forth viewpoint-wise. And that's, you know, and then the editing process came with Colin, and he was able to call me out on where maybe I had, you know, leaned too far one way or the other with a character or with a scene. And he helped me find that balance. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's truly 50-50 because like everybody, I have my biases. So I'm sure even if I was trying not to, you know, you don't have a 20-year career in law enforcement and not come down at least slightly biased towards law enforcement. So, mm-hmm. you know, if it's 51-49, I was willing to live with that. The worst criticism I've heard so far in terms of that, one of the readers told me he thought it was about 60-40. So, you know, I can live with that even, you know, I mean, if I have to, so.
Mm-hmm. But that's interesting. And it's certainly an interesting approach, which brings me to my next question. The other four that you did, you had mentioned prior that Mr. Conway and yourself break up characters. In other words, Mr. Mm-hmm. Conway will write some characters, you'll write some characters. Mm-hmm. How do you mesh them together? Like, say two of the characters are you and I, and we're conversing right now. How mm-hmm. do you mesh that together in the editing process?
Yeah, that's where it does get meshed together, because I might be writing the chapters from Wardell Clint's point of view, but Wardell Clint is going to be in some chapters that Colin's writing, right? That mm-hmm. are from the point of view of characters that he's writing. And so it is in the editing that is fixed. And so really what it comes down to is you kind of get to be the warden of your own character's true north a little bit. So if you're editing, if you wrote a chapter that contained the character that I wrote and I felt like you were off in the way he was responding or she was acting, then I, you know, Colin and I both gave each other 100% veto, 100% heavy-handed editing power. You go in and fix it. And then I send it back to you and you look at it and you're like, oh, that looks fixed to me. Or you say, no, I didn't. And, you know, and you start batting it back and forth until you get total agreement. But with having that ability to, you know, say anything, change anything, address anything, nothing goes unchallenged. So the characters end up remaining true to themselves.
Interesting. Cause that novella I read of yours, there's a lot of incidental conversation that happens. Like there was a point in that novella where one guy said, I watched it on the History Channel or something to that effect. Who controls the incidental conversations that happen? Because that mm-hmm. is part of your style. I don't know if it's part of mm-hmm. Mr. Conway's style, but.
You know, we have similar, but not the same styles. I'm a little more verbose than he is, I think, which should be shocking to anybody that's been watching this podcast, I'm sure. he's a lot better at getting straight to the point. Sometimes too much so, just like I sometimes go on too long. So we help each other out in that regard. You know, the incidental conversations, most of the time it's the responsibility of whoever's writing that chapter. But when you go through the editing process, sometimes you'll see an opportunity to slide a comment in or, you know, a quick exchange or a behavior or something that really helps bring home the characterization of that person. And you put it in there and let the other guy see it. And if he recognizes it for what it is, then great. You move on. And if you disagree, you chat about why. And I got to tell you, I mean, we've written 6 books together, 5 in this series. We've had some heated conversations, and by heated, I don't mean angry, but I do mean like we both really believed in what we were saying and they weren't the same thing. So we've had these strident conversations a few times, not very often, but we've never been unable to resolve them. And one or the other of us is always able to recognize ultimately who's right. You know, and sometimes it's him and sometimes it's me. And it's all about putting your ego aside and doing what's best for the book. And also trusting your partner. It's like a marriage in a way. I mean, if you know your partner has your best and the book's best interests at heart, and that's what's motivating him, then the only conflict is conceptual, the idea. I don't agree with the idea that you're stating, and that's it. There's no ulterior motive to consider. There's none of that comes into play. It's a, you know, it's one dimension of argument. Because you trust the person, and, you know, and that makes a huge difference. In other human relations, you know, you always have the surface argument, but you have all the ulterior considerations and all these other things that come into play that kind of muddy the waters. And we don't have that in our writing collaboration at all. And that trust really goes a long way, I think, towards helping us get to the very best version of what we're trying to create.
Right. So he might come to you and say, you know, what the hell is this guy doing at a Seattle Mariners game? This character would never go to a Seattle Mariners game.
I'll give you a real life example in this book, The Ride Along. It just came out. When I sent him the first draft, I'd already let my wife read it because of timing issues. He wasn't ready for it yet. So, I let her read it because she was going to read it anyway. And she came back and she was like, I love Lee. He's great. I don't like Melody. She's this and that. But, you know, I thought Lee was great. I send it to Colin. He comes back and he's like, I hate Lee. I hate the officer in this book. And I hate him, but you know, I mean, shorthand for there's problems with him. I'm like, oh, wow. What's that? We can't have that. You have to at least respect both of them and hopefully like both of them as people at some level for this to work. And he said, what did he call it? He called it, thin-skinned Salter. He said he's being whiny about everything. He's like this, everything this woman says, he's got like thin skin. He's getting upset. He's calling his sergeant. He's reacting he's not being very professional. And I had wanted to show how hard it is to have somebody sitting in your car criticizing you doing your job, because it is. But I way overshot, you know, and so mm-hmm. he reeled me back in. He said, no, you can't have that, or people are going to all side, except for the extreme cop lovers, or everybody's going to side with this ride along, and we won't accomplish the goal here, which is even handedness, which is to present both ideas in an even way. So he reeled it in and, you know, saved the book in that regard. And I've done that for him in a couple of his solo works. And it's all because, like I said, we both know the other guy has I got your back. You know, I'm doing this because I don't want you to walk out in public with your zipper down and your shirt untucked, you know, it's not about, let me show you how much smarter I am or how much better of a writer I am than you. And I'll lord this over you that I found a mistake in your manuscript or some, you know, crap like that. It's a true, you know, caring partnership. And so I feel pretty lucky that, you know, that we've been able to do this for 5 books now, and at least one more that we're going to do.
It sounds like a productive and, you know, it sounds like a very good partnership that you have there. Now, you did some other series. I was looking at this earlier today with some other writers, mm-hmm. Eric Beatner. Now, this seems like it, because I haven't read the Brick and Cam Jobs series. It seems like it might be completely different from your normal genre.
I would say somewhat different. Yeah. Eric is the guy I mentioned before who had the podcast that kind of inspired me. One of the all-time greatest guys in crime fiction. I love him. Just a super nice guy. One of the cleanest first draft authors I've ever known. And I highly, highly recommend if you like fast moving action, in your crime fiction, then check out Eric Beatner. He's got a slew of books and they're all good. Funny thing, I'd written this series with that's below that, the Anya series with Jim Wilski. I'd written with Colin, and I kept bothering Eric. I was like, hey, let's write together sometime. And he kept putting me off, you know, he's kind of keeping me at an arm's length, and I was almost turning into a stalker about it, you know? And he said, look, hey, it's not you, you know, it's not you, it's me, you know, but he was like, it's not you. I did it with one time already. I had a collaboration experiment. It went really well. I totally beat the odds. I don't see that lottery ticket hitting again. So I don't want to risk screwing up a good friendship by working together. And I was like, that's not going to happen. And, you know, he didn't want to do it. Finally, you know, I'm talking 3-4 years. I hit him up every once in a while about it. Finally, I can't remember if I said something to him that spurred it or if he just came out of the blue with it, but he finally said to me, you know what? I got this idea. What if there was, like, what if the mafia had to downsize? And so they gave like a couple of competing lists to these two different hitmen that didn't know each other, and whoever did the best job gets to keep their job and the other one is out of work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so is it a comedy? He goes, nah, it's an action with some dark comedy in it. I said, I'm on board. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the character of Paula Bricky Bricks. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of a sharp tongued, pretty world weary, cynical person whose dad worked for the mafia. So she's a legacy hire, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he wrote Cameron, who is trying to break into the business. And he's kind of he creates mayhem. Like, his nickname eventually becomes Slaughterhouse because, you know, he could go buy a stick of bubble gum and the store would explode. I mean, that's kind of what happens with him. And so they both, like I said, they get these competing lists of outstanding accounts and they have to try to, you know, beat the other person. And of course, they eventually become aware of each other and things, they don't get romantic. So don't get your hopes up, but they do become partners and things went on for a total of 3 books there. And it was a lot of fun. Like I said, some dark comedy. My comedy was more sarcasm and things Bricks would say. Eric's comedy tended to be gross things that happen. And he won the gross out award in all three books, hands down, I think. I won't give you any spoilers, but trust me, if you're reading the Cam chapters, that's where you're gonna land on.
That's cool.
On the gross out award for each book.
And what about the Anya series? What's the gist?
Those are more your hard boiled, almost noir series. The first one, all of them, much like Brooks and Cam, they're two characters in each book. In these books, it's two different main characters each time. I wrote one, Jim wrote the other, and we wrote it in the alternating chapter sort of format with both of them being in the first person. It's the same thing with the Brooks and Cam jobs. And in the first one, you got a couple of brothers, Mick and Jersey, who are half brothers, and on their dad's in prison, and on his deathbed, he tells him about a job he pulled that not all the diamonds got recovered. And that sends him kind of on a quest to recover these diamonds, but they're also trying to sabotage each other a little bit. Sort of a Cain and Abel meet the Hardy Boys, I guess, you know, sort of thing. Meet Breaking Bad type of deal. Mm-hmm. And along the way, you can see the blonde in the background there. One of them, and eventually both of them, meet this femme fatale named Anya. And she was just a character that Jim introduced early on in the book. And you talk about, you know, characters kind of dictating their own path. She suddenly exploded into, you know, it became a three-person book, even though she didn't have any POV chapters. And ultimately, she became the through thread of the entire series, because as the series continues in each of the following three books, you have two different characters that each of us narrated, but Anya is the third character through all of them. And so like I said, it's hard boiled, leaning towards noir at times. The last book there is the prequel, kind of an origin story for Anya.
Harbinger?
Don't agree.
Harbinger?
Yeah, Harbinger.
Okay.
Uh-huh. We disagree on, like I say, this is the order you should read them in. That's why I put them in this order on my website. I think that the reveals in Harbinger that tell you about the origin story of Anya pack a pretty big punch after you've read the first three books. Jim is in favor of reading it first. So, and it works either way. It's really up to the reader, but this is the way I would go about it.
It's like The Godfather. Can you watch Godfather 2 before for one?
Yeah, not the Michael sections.
Yeah. So now I have to ask you about some of these other series. I'm enthralled about, there seems to be a wide range, but they all have an underlying theme. So the Spokompton series?
Yeah, so Spokane has many nicknames. Officially, it's the Lilac City. You know, Spokaloo, and, you know, all kinds of different things people call it. But one of the things that they have called it in years past is Spokompton, because the crime rate was pretty rough for a little while. And also there was a bit of a migration from Compton, California to Spokane during the crack epidemic.
In the 90s.
And so the Spokompton series is, you know, if you look at the top of my website, the tagline there is gritty crime fiction from both sides of the badge. Well, this is the underside of the badge. This is the flip side of things. All of these books, I'm working on the fourth one right now, actually. They're from the criminal side of things, not the cop side. I mean, the cops aren't necessarily bad in these books, but from the view of the protagonists, they're the bad guys. And they're not the same character in each book. They kind of all stand alone, but there are recurring and overlapping characters and storylines. So,
all from the criminal's point of view?
All of them are from the criminal's point of view, yeah. Mm. I've had this called by some people kind of as a geographic series. They all take place in the same place, and the same people kind of pop in and out of the stories, but somebody different is the center point of each book. Mm-hmm. And they're a lot of fun because, you know, I mean, I've explored the police experience a lot in my writing career, and I enjoy that for a variety of reasons. But it's kind of cool to, you know, to to put on the dirty clothes and go in the dark alleys.
Get on the other side for a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Jack McRae mysteries.
These are kind of like the Copriva mystery series. These are private detective series.
Ah.
Although they're not like, neither of them are licensed PIs, but that's the subgenre that they would go in, private investigator. Jack McRae is a police detective. He retires at about 57. He's had kind of a mediocre, unremarkable career. And the tagline for the series is, you know, first Jack McRae retired, then things got interesting. you know, he ends up in that first book. He is approached by a woman who is actually the daughter of a woman that he was involved with many, many years ago. I mean, she was like 10 and now she's 30. So, you know, 30 something. So over 20 years ago. And his, you know, but he lived with her for about a year and it didn't work out. And now her mother's died and she discovered a photograph of a little girl about 4 or 5 years old sitting on her mother's lap that is very obviously her daughter. I mean, the you know, it's too much of a
coincidence. Yeah.
They look too much alike, you know, the resemblance is just, you know, but nobody knows anything about this or nobody will tell her anything about this. And so she wants to find out about this sister she didn't know she ever had. And she goes to Jack or to Mac, because when you do a little cocktail napkin math, it could be his kid. And she needs some expertise because she's getting, she's running into roadblocks everywhere she goes trying to ask questions. So he accompanies her down to a small town in Oregon, that is kind of ruled by the family. That's kind of small town politics is what he runs into. And they try to find this little girl. And then, the rest of the series, you know, is things happening to him. And the second one here, it'll be out next month. You know, it's quite a few years later and his mentor has died and his mentor's son comes to him with a letter that he found in which his mentor confesses seemingly to doing something wrong, but he's a little vague about it. And, his son wants to know what it was. And so now Mac has to find out what his hero did wrong. And it jumps off from there.
Everything you're describing so far, I can't wait to see it on Netflix.
I would like that.
Yeah, because it's very descriptive, and you know, it gets you involved. Lawrence Kelter, with Lawrence Kelter series.
Yeah. Larry Kelter is a New York based writer. He's got probably his flagship series is his Stephanie Chalice thrillers. But he's written a bunch of other stuff. Actually, as quick side note, he's written the novelization of the My Cousin Vinny and a couple of authorized sequels to that. So if people liked that movie and those characters, there's some books that are based very closely on the original character and the script.
Interesting.
He collaborated on it with the screenwriter that wrote the movie. And he came to me, this first book, The Last Caller, he came to me and said, hey, I want to write a procedural and I want to write with you because I want someone who's done the job and I want that kind of, you know, that authenticity to this story. And I said, okay, well, here's how I've been doing it. You know, we'll write first person, two characters back and forth. And this is how, you know, I've done it in the past. And he's like, yeah, I don't really want to do it that way. So let's try one character. And I was a little worried about it, to be honest with you, because, you know, when you're writing two different characters in alternating chapters, it's okay that they sound completely different. In fact, it's probably what you want, right?
It's
you want
beneficial. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's the whole point. I was worried that we'd have a schizophrenic sounding main character, you know? And, but I was like, I'll give it a try. You never know. So we came up with the storyline and we started writing this and, you know, we write 1, 2, 3 chapters, whatever. We take it to a certain point and pass it back and forth. And it was in the first person, so it was a little odd to be writing it in the first person with two different writers. And it probably was a little bit schizophrenic first draft, but once we started editing it, we both edited it with a very heavy hand. And by the time we had a finished draft, I got to be honest with you, aside from a couple of tells, like phrases that that slip into my writing sometime that I know were mine, or a couple of jokes that I knew were mine, 98% of it, I couldn't tell you if I wrote it or just edited that passage. And so what really evolved over the course of the editing was a kind of a third voice, not his voice, not my voice, but this third voice unique to the character. And so
that's very interesting. To give me a little nuts and bolts, like he would send you some words that the character went through. Were you reactionary? Did you see a path where he would need to go from there?
Well, we actually mapped out the book before we started so that we didn't go down. So we didn't throw curveballs to each other. Like okay. when I was writing with Jim Wilski, we had a kind of a funny story. You know, we had a roadmap, you know, hey, these guys are going to look for these diamonds and here's where they find the diamonds if they find them or where they resolve the search anyway. And, you know, maybe it's 20 chapters total, let's say. About chapter 6 or so, he had a scene where his guy found the diamonds. And I just had to say to him, I remember saying, Jim, you know, Whiskey Tango Foxtrot here. I mean, now what, you know.
This is going to be a short story.
Well, yeah. And it's a huge curveball. And he was like, yeah, it just seemed like it felt good. And it actually did work in the scene. And if he was writing the book by himself, he probably could have run with it and it would have been great, but it totally tanked a whole lot of stuff that we had already set up. So, he was like, yeah, my bad. Let's backtrack and go with what we already laid out. Mm-hmm. Having a roadmap, you keeps you from going down, you know, taking side trips that throw the other person for a loop. So yeah, Larry would write, you know, a chapter, two chapters, three chapters, whatever it was, you take it to this point, he'd send it to me and I would usually go through and do a quick edit on it and then write my part and then send it back to him. And so we'd rotate back and forth with, you know, edit, you know, review what you just edited of mine and then write my new chapter sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And Colin and I do that as well. And the result is you end up with, you know, draft 1.5 or 2.0 when you get to the end of the first draft rather than just draft 1.0. And it works pretty well, as a process.
Well, I want to go back to, I have to get to the top of your page to get back to the River City series for a second. Actually, let me get here. I'll ask you a question I've always wanted to ask Larry King. Where the hell do you find the time to write all this stuff?
Well, you know, I retired in 2013. I taught on the road for the International Association of Chiefs of Police. They had a leadership program that I taught for about 4 years. So I was on the road for 2-3 weeks a month. So I didn't write a ton during that time period, but at the end of 2017, I hung up my PowerPoint clicker and I've been working full-time as a writer since then. So, you know, I treat it as my job and I'm not a harsh taskmaster. I don't, you know, refuse, you know, I don't, you work Christmas Eve, damn it. You know, I'm not that kind of a boss, but
well, how many hours a day do you think you devote to actually writing?
Writing, it varies. Working on the writing related career stuff, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm putting in 6, 8, 10 hours a day. Mm. And sometimes on the weekends, if I'm in the middle of a project, I generally try to get up early and write in the morning when I'm freshest, when I have the biggest energy, creative energy, the juice is really flowing there, you know, give your best self to yourself, that sort of approach.
Right.
And then do editing and marketing in the afternoon and evening. But the nice part about it is being your own boss, you know, if I can tell I'm drained and I'm not getting, you know, and I'm struggling to do something, to get words on the page, or, you know, the editing is not flowing or whatever, if I have to take a day off or change it up, I have all the latitude to do that. Hmm. But it's not a job for me in the sense that, you know, I'm punching a clock and I'm looking at that same clock, wondering when it's time to go home. And I hate my boss and I hate my office. And, you know, I've wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid. And now that's what I'm doing full time. I'm 53 years old. I've been doing it full time, you know, for the last 5 years. And, mm-hmm. It's a labor of love, very, very literally. And so when I put that time in, it doesn't necessarily feel like there's no resentment there, you know, like you might if you were working for someone else and putting in long hours.
Mm-hmm. And the podcast on top of that. When you are writing, do you, because your style of writing is very cinematic, do you have like a film in your head that you're?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely that you nailed it. I do see it as a film in my head, and you know, hopefully someday people will see it as a film on their television.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But, I see that in your future. Yeah.
Well, I hope you're clairvoyant then.
So you have these, and I appreciate your time tonight, Frank. And it was
my pleasure. Right?
I found it to be extremely interesting. All of the different genres and the ones you co-wrote with the other writers. You have the seven here, and then you have the eighth one of this series. I'm talking about the River City series, mm-hmm. coming out, what did you say, around August?
August or September. It's a little bit fluid at the moment. But
do you have a working title, or do you want to?
Yeah, it's called The Worst Kind of Truth.
Uh-huh. Well, before I let you go, I have to ask you, who's doing your book cover designs? They're awesome.
I pretty much work with two different cover designers. These are Eric Buettner, mm-hmm. the aforementioned Eric Buettner, who does my River City series. If you go back to the novel page, I can tell you who's doing the different series, because he does these. He does the Stefan Kopriva series as well, which is a spin-off series. Kopriva obviously is a River City police officer in the first couple of books. Mm-hmm. That's also Eric, and he just redid that Lovely Dark and Deep, actually, to kind of marry it up a little bit more to the Friends of the Departed.
The one constant in the book, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, but is the book covers is the badge. Is that your badge?
That is the shape of a Spokane police badge, an old style Spokane police badge. It says River City, obviously, instead of Spokane. And the seal mm-hmm. is not the state seal, because that is illegal to use mm-hmm. for commercial purposes.
Right.
That design, that waterfall design, which really fits the city, was created by a publisher in Spokane who was the print publisher for this series for a number of years while they were publishing fiction. When they got out of the fiction game, I republished the books myself, but he created the seal there. I think it works really well. I mean,
yeah, that's the one constant I saw on the book. But I interrupted you about the designer. You directed Eric, me somewhere.
If you slow down just a little bit. Eric Buettner did the Kopriva series there, just above. He did the second two anyway. Mm-hmm. The bricks and cam jobs were done by, and of course I'm spacing the guy's name right now because it's the end of the day and I'm losing steam. I'll think of it here in a minute.
Well, it is a different style. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's a great guy. He's done a number of books. Now this is done by my other designer, Zach McCain, who's just a wizard. He created this battered pulp fiction, pulp novel sort of look for this series that I just think is outstanding.
I like it myself. Yeah.
And then the Troy 316 series. So the guy whose name I'm spacing right now, and I'm going to get it, but real quick here, he did the first one, and then Zach McCain did the remaining four in the series. Mm-hmm. Then these are Buettner's. He did these. He does my Spokompton series.
For those listening to us, we're at the Spoke Compton series of his website that I'd like to direct you to after this podcast. But go ahead, sir.
Those are Eric Buettner designs. And then the McRae series is another Zach McCain. These were all done. The Lawrence Kelter books were all three done by independent contractors that I reached out to separately. I think the middle one there is done by Damon Zaw, who's pretty well known in the independent field. And then the other two were done by designers that I just linked up to.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put you on the spot by asking you that.
I know for most of them.
Yeah, I dug the covers of especially, well, I liked them all. I liked the different styles, but especially like the covers of the River Series books. They're very well done. So kudos to that gentleman you mentioned. And so now my challenge is to read all seven of these before the eighth one comes out in August. Are they all? Well, I'm sure they're all full books, yeah. But I had a very interesting hour. It was very nice of you to take your time. I don't know what time it is in Washington. So I know it's getting late here in New York.
JT in Oregon. Andrews. That's who it was. The other designer. I can't believe I couldn't remember his name. JT Lindrus.
Okay. So
who's living over in Europe right now.
Shout out to all those designers. Did an excellent job. And I'm really looking forward to getting deeper involved in your work, Frank. I did read the one novella, and you're a very talented writer. I like the way you described your style as well. And just look at the show notes, whether you are on YouTube or Spotify or Google or Apple, and visit frankzaffiro.com, and you'll see all of these books that we were just discussing. And thank you so much for your time tonight, Frank. It was quite enjoyable.
No, thank you. Thanks for some great questions and letting me rattle on. I could talk about writing for 4 or 5 hours easily. So thanks for the opportunity. Well,
it was our pleasure. And we'll see you on Netflix soon, all of these books, especially the River Series books. All right. Have a great night, sir. Thank you again.
You too.
Take care.